Now a look inside the world of high finance on Wall Street and the young people who go into the business.
Our next guest immersed himself in the world of new recruits to financial firms like Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. He found a culture changed by the financial crisis of 2008 and the Great Recession that followed.
Kevin Roos joins us now. He is a business and technology writer for New York Magazine. His new book that we'll be discussing is Young Money, Inside the Hidden World of Wall Street's Post-Crash Recruits. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start out with the why of this book, because it's such an interesting topic, you know, in the wake of the fall of Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers and all of that. You decided that you wanted to take a look at that sort of post-crash world and this group of young people that go into it. And I have to say, I was pretty amazed at some of the sheer numbers of people who go into finance who you wouldn't necessarily expect go in that direction.
It's incredible. For many years, Wall Street has been the number one destination for graduates of top Ivy League schools, and sometimes as many as 40 or 45% of graduates from these schools are going on to Wall Street after graduation. So it's an incredible magnet. And I was curious to see who was going into this industry after the crisis, when everyone was everyone was so angry at Wall Street banks, and the recession had thrust many people out of their homes and had dissipated savings. Who was still interested in becoming a Wall Street banker? So I decided to follow 8 first and second year junior bankers through 2 or 3 years on the job.
And I want to talk a little bit about how you followed them, because I think that's important. And I don't want to say this is unauthorized, but you had to use, you know, pseudonyms. You had to make up some details to obscure other facts and so forth. But you talked to 8 actual people, but not necessarily on the record.
Correct. I mean, Wall Street is an extremely secretive place, and all of these big banks have rules against talking to the media. So these 8 young people were putting their jobs on the line, in effect, by talking to me. So, yeah, I had to give them anonymity. I had to change certain details so that their coworkers wouldn't recognize them. This was an extremely risky thing for them to do.
Now, the path that that these young people were taking is one that leads to lots and lots and lots and lots of money. And I'm wondering, as you set out to start this, did you have a hypothesis about what you were going to find?
I thought it would be sort of a bunch of miniature Gordon Geckos. I mean, people who really had nothing on their minds except for money, people who, you know, knew exactly what they wanted out of Wall Street, which was to make as much money as possible.
And what you found from my reading of the book is different. You found, in the 8 people that you follow, a pretty wide cast of characters. These were people with a wide variety of interests, not necessarily in business, and they all sort of wound up on Wall Street. But as it turns out, a lot of people sort of wind up there. Talk about that process a little bit.
That was one of the most fascinating things, is that it turns out that Wall Street has been an attraction to even college students who don't have an interest in economics or in business. For many years, Wall Street was sort of the default option. If you didn't know what else to do with your life after you went to Harvard or Princeton or Yale, you might well end up on Wall Street, even if you had studied philosophy or art history, because these banks are very, very good at recruiting. They come onto campuses, they make the process very easy. And they say, even if you don't study finance, even if you're not particularly interested in finance, come here, spend 2 years working for us. We'll teach you everything you need to know, and then you can go off and do whatever you're passionate about.
And those 2 years are interesting, because at the end of the 2 years, that's sort of the dividing line there. And we need to talk about those 2 years. What are those 2 years like for those folks who come into this? Why is it so tough? And then what is so important about that 2 year mark? And then what happens on after that?
Well, the first 2 years are essentially you are essentially an office grunt. I mean, they're called analysts, and basically what that means is that you are putting together PowerPoint presentations, Excel spreadsheets, and you're doing this for sometimes upwards of 100 hours a week. So there's a thing that young bankers talk about called the banker 9-to-5, which is when you show up for work at 9 a.m. and you don't leave until 5 a.m. the next morning. So it's a 20-hour shift, and that's not irregular. I mean, these people are on call all the time. They are constantly being interrupted in their personal lives. They have no time to enjoy the money that they're making, and it really takes a toll on them. I was shocked by the amount of depression, anxiety, and real misery that manifests itself among these young people.
And one of the people you talked to might resonate with some of our listeners, Derek from Waupaca. I wound up going to school in Madison, worked in Chicago for a bit, and then went to the bright lights of New York.
Absolutely. He was one of my favorite people that I met through this book because he really embodied the Wall Street-Main Street divide. I mean, he was from a small town in Wisconsin. He went to a state school. He didn't have the pedigree that a lot of people who end up on Wall Street do. And yet he ended up in New York working in private equity, making upwards of $200,000 a year. And he was really conflicted about what he was doing. He had you know, people back home that he looked up to who sort of asked him, you know, what are you doing on Wall Street? And he wasn't always proud of the answer to that question. So it was really interesting to see these young people go through the process of figuring out who they were and what values they represented.
We're going to continue the discussion in a second. We're talking to Kevin Roos. He is the author of Young Money, Inside the Hidden World of Wall Street's Post-Crash Recruits.
And you can join the show with your questions. And if you've tried to break into the world of high finance, or maybe your son or your daughter has, tell us your story. And should our financial system be in the hands of ambitious 22-year-olds? What does that mean? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now with Kevin Roos, author of Young Money, about the life of fledgling Wall Street recruits.
And you can join in the discussion if you'd like. If you've got a question or a comment about our topic, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us talk@wpr.org. Kevin, before the break, we were talking a little bit about Derek from Waupaca, but the interesting thing about these eight people that you follow is that, you know, I had this hypothesis that they would all sort of be the same, but they were eight individuals who wound up taking eight really kind of different journeys in this 2-year period. And I'm not sure that I expected that when I started the book.
I certainly didn't when I started reporting it. I mean, I think I tend to think, like most people, that Wall Street is sort of a cultural monolith, that the depictions that we see in movies like The Wolf of Wall Street are more or less accurate. And I was actually shocked by how untrue those depictions are, how diverse Wall Street can be. And it's not just sort of racially and gender-wise, although there certainly is more of that than I think we typically see. But it's the internal conflict as well. I didn't expect to find young Wall Street people who had doubts and skepticism about their own roles. But I was sort of delighted to find that there was actually a certain amount of dissonance among these people about what they were being asked to do.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember which person it was. I think maybe it was Samson, the one who kept the diary. And, he started out when it's my first day going to work and it's going to be great, dot, dot, dot. And by the end, his diary was like a totally different place.
Right. He was fantasizing about killing himself on the trading floor. I mean, it really, these months on, you know, working, he was working at Goldman Sachs, and just the sort of rigmarole of everyday life and the fact that he was sort of conflicted ethically about this work really, really took a toll. So I think, you know, this can best be described by the fact that Samson and his best friend Jeremy, who also worked at Goldman Sachs, started calling the building Azkaban, like the place in Harry Potter where the prison where people's souls are sucked out of their bodies. I mean, it really felt like a soul-crushing experience to them.
And, you know, for a lot of the people in the book, there was that soul-crushing element and the grind that you talk about, you know, the endless work weeks, the strain on relationships, the tactics the companies use to sort of keep people in the building and those sorts of things. You know, that two-year period then has the promise of that third-year offer and then being a millionaire by the time you're, you know, 30 or 35 or whatever. What do the companies do to try to work with some of those guilty feelings, with some of that conflict, to try to get those analysts to make it to that third year?
Well, until recently, they didn't have to do much because the money was so attractive and the analysts were willing to put up with the indignities of the job for the hope of making it to the senior level one day. But in the last few years, we've seen sort of a flow of people moving from Wall Street, actually quitting their jobs and moving out of the industry. So there are people now who are leaving Wall Street banks and going to Silicon Valley tech firms like Google and Facebook and small startups out there. And I think this is really unprecedented in the last few decades. Wall Street has always managed to keep the people that it wants. But that's no longer the case. People have more options now, and they're increasingly exercising them.
And, you know, one of the other things that was interesting in the book, that promise we talk about that big Wall Street career and becoming one of the big players in the world of high finance, when you get there in your 30s, 40s, and 50s, allegedly, you know, something else happens to you. But then you went to this dinner, this Kappa Beta Phi dinner that you attended undercover, I might add. Tell the audience about that, because that was very instructive for me and for what these analysts have the possibility of turning into if they stick around long enough.
Well, Kappa Beta Phi is a secret Wall Street society made up of CEOs and executives from most of the major financial institutions. It was started in the 1920s. It's still around today. And every year they have their annual induction ceremony where they bring in new members. So I snuck into this induction ceremony. I was the first reporter to ever see the whole thing. And I watched as they not only humiliated the new members by making them dress up in drag and do sort of musical numbers and comedy skits, but they also, these skits tended to be pretty offensive. I mean, they were not only sexist, homophobic jokes being made, but there were a number of skits that actually mocked the people who had been protesting Wall Street. There were things mocking the Occupy movement and mocking the bailouts. There was a song that they sang called Bailout King that was set to the tune of ABBA's Dancing Queen. So really offensive stuff. And what surprised me is that, you know, when I saw this, obviously, and then eventually out, you know, got caught and sort of thrust out of the building, I told the young people about what I'd seen, the young people that I was following, and they thought it was as ridiculous as I did. So I think, you know, it was a little heartening to hear that there's sort of a generation gap in finance as well, that the young people don't necessarily see the world the way that some of the older people do.
Is it too easy to divide that up into pre-crash and post-crash?
I don't think so. I think that's actually a pretty good way to divide it up. The people who have been in finance for many years, they came of age during a time when Wall Street was really not altogether accountable. I mean, it was a far different financial industry than it is now. And I think what you're seeing now is that young people aren't as enamored of the Wall Street culture because they aren't reaping the benefits of it. For a lot of them, they're sort of ashamed to say that they work on Wall Street.
And so as the 2 years started to wind down, and I should remind the audience that you were meeting with them in bars and in their apartments and in these really informal places, basically wherever they could, and sort of flying under the radar. But as you got, you know, closer to the end of this second year, what were they thinking? I mean, everybody, that second year was such a big, you know, you're either in or you're out kind of moment. Were they all kind of going toward in the same direction using the same thought processes, or were we really talking about eight individual decisions being made here?
I think it was absolutely eight individual decisions. I think some people, you know, decided that they wanted to do this for the rest of their lives. Some people decided that they definitely did not want to do it. And a few people had the decision sort of made for them, either by not getting offers back or actually in one case by being laid off. So I think there's a real sort of, these are real individuals who all went through their own soul-searching process about whether finance and investment banking was something that they could see themselves doing into the future.
And there were eight sort of different outcomes. Samson, for example, the guy we talked about before, he wound up going off and doing that startup and making that big leap. And he was he was the guy, I think, who had the countdown clock in his room, right?
Yeah, he had a clock in his room that told him the number of days until he got his bonus. And at that point, he was going to quit.
And Derek from Waupaca, he wound up staying on Wall Street.
He stayed, and that was, you know, the most surprising thing to me is that that some of the, it was sort of hard to predict who would stay and who wouldn't. And so I think in his case, he was conflicted about Wall Street, but he ended up deciding that, you know what, I'm going to spend at least a few more years here, and I like making this kind of money, and I think ultimately it's going to be good for my career.
We've got to go in about 30 seconds or so, but you say at the end of your book, for the first time in decades, the big banks are beginning to lose their grip, and that's good for all of us.
I think so. We're seeing now that Wall Street doesn't have the same allure among young people that it did even 5 years ago, and I think that's probably a good thing for the rest of the economy.
Well, Kevin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Kevin Roos. He is the author of the book we've been talking about, Young Money, about the life of young people on Wall Street.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time is Food Friday. This week, we'll learn about kombucha and find out why the fermented tea is picking up in popularity.
Earlier this week, the Census of Employment and Wages ranked Wisconsin 35th in the nation in private sector job growth.
But that same census also showed that Dane County, located in south-central Wisconsin and home to Madison, ranked second in the nation for private sector wage increases.
Mike Ivey joins us now. He's a business reporter for the Capital Times in Madison, and he explains why Dane County's getting high marks in private sector ratings. Mike, welcome back.
Hi, guys.
Well, the census looked at data from September 2012 to September 2013. How much had local private sector wages in Dane County increased over those last 12 months?
Well, they're on average about 9.3%, which is, that's a lot. It's a good way to put it. Statewide wages were up about 3%. Which is actually not too bad, because nationally wages were up 1.9%. I know I'm throwing a lot of numbers at you there, but I think the story there is that Dane County, which has kind of been embracing the technology and new economy sectors, has really kind of stands apart from the rest of the state.
Well, let's look at that, because Dane County is outpacing the rest of Wisconsin, and it sounds like what's driving it largely is technology. Can you dive into that a little more and tell us what?
Well, I don't know if people have heard of Epic Systems, which is now the largest technology employer in the entire state. They make the software that so many doctors are now using to keep their medical records. Part of Obamacare required that all healthcare facilities in the U.S. eventually convert to an electronic healthcare system. Epic had been doing that before, but they've had a tremendous growth since Obamacare went into effect, and also before that, because people were planning. So they've got over 6,000 employees now working on the Madison Far West Side. Their headquarters is actually located in Verona. So that has had a tremendous impact on the local economy, because those jobs are paying $50,000, $60,000 for people coming right out of college. And then, you know, some of their other people that have been there a while are making a lot more than that. With that said, we should also note that Epic is only about 2% of the total employment base in Dane County. So I think there's been some spin-off development from that. There's been quite a bit of apartment building and real estate investment that's gone on, partly because a lot of these people that have come to work for Epic want to live in downtown Madison near the restaurants and the bars and the nightlife. So that's fueled kind of this boom, and I think a lot of it has all come together, and some of these numbers are starting to reflect that.
So if we do go with the Epic theory, is the idea here that Epic is booming right now, maybe because of Obamacare, and that they're paying really well?
They are paying well, and it's spurring some growth in some other offshoot companies. So there's people that had worked at Epic have now started their own companies, helping people who have the software learn how to navigate through it, and so that's worked as well. Also, what's happened here, too, and I think it's important to note, is Dane County and Madison in particular is home to three large hospitals, and hospitals, medical care in general, has been growing. It continues to be a big chunk of the economy. Those jobs tend to pay pretty well, and that was sort of recession-proof. I mean, people still get sick and go to the hospital no matter what the broader economy is doing. So there's been some growth in that area as well. So, I mean, I think this has been going on for a while, but these numbers were sort of validated. And I should add, too, that some of the people that follow these things real closely have pointed out there may be a statistical quirk at work here that suddenly boosted with Dane County up above some of these other counties. And so some of the economists are drilling a little deeper into that. So we may know more as these next round of numbers do come out.
Well, obviously, the rest of the state would love to duplicate what Dane County has shown right now, this 9.3% increase in private sector wages. Is there a lesson that the rest of the state can extrapolate, or is it just the circumstances that are specific to Dane County?
Find an Epic system to move to your community. Yeah, I mean, I think the news here is that Wisconsin wages actually have been ticking up a little faster than the national average. Like I said before, they're up 3%. I think some of that reflects the rebound that we've seen in manufacturing. Wisconsin was, I believe, fifth in number of manufacturing jobs added over this period that the feds were looking at. Nationally, wages are only up 1.9%. I mean, this has been partly a jobless recovery, but in a lot of ways it's been a non-wage increase recovery. So I think seeing the wages start to catch up is maybe what people really need to see. I've always said that people in Wisconsin don't need a tax break. They need a pay hike. And I think that's we have lagged on pay and income for quite a few years. We have fallen behind Minnesota in terms of per capita income and wage growth. And so maybe things will start to level off a little bit. But, you know, the high-paying jobs are in those technology and medical fields. And Wisconsin, for better or worse, has a lot of its economy. It's been rooted in agriculture, in old-line manufacturing, paper-making, forestry, some of those industries that just have not, you know, you're not going to make a lot of money working a lot of those jobs these days.
There is another area that seems to be credited for the hike, and that is education services. We haven't talked about that yet. What falls under that umbrella?
Yeah, that sort of left some of the economists scratching their heads. Whether that was was this a sudden jump in charter schools or Globe University hiring a bunch of people. I think this would be administrative things related to education. But we need to remember that this is private sector stuff we're looking at. So this is not one of the wraps on Madison is that it's, you know, you've got the state government there and that's why your jobs pay more. But this is all private sector stuff. So I asked that question myself and that's where they thought maybe there was some statistical quirk. Some reason the feds lump education and health services into the same category. I encourage people, if they're really this interested in it, go to the Cap Times website, click on my story on this, and there's all kind of, you can bury yourself in economic statistics if you want to.
One thing I want to talk about, Dane County, it's different a little bit from the rest of Wisconsin that it doesn't rely as much on manufacturing jobs. What do you know about counties and states that do rely on manufacturing and how that's affected wage increases and job growth?
I think that's why we have seen the wages for the state tick up a little higher than the rest of the country, because those manufacturing jobs do tend to pay better than the some of the service sector jobs, retail, leisure hospitality is always kind of a low-paying industry, restaurant and hotel workers, and even some of the forestry and paper-making jobs. So manufacturing does tend to pay higher. not as high as the high-tech jobs, but it does pay higher than those other sectors. And Wisconsin has, like I said earlier, has had a nice rebound in manufacturing, because manufacturing still is the largest goods-producing sector in the state.
Do you think the job market in Wisconsin, like, say, the stock market, where you get some good news like this and all of a sudden everyone's feeling confident and more jobs and higher wages start cropping up?
That all starts to play together. I mean, all these surveys on employers are feeling more upbeat. We talked last week, I think it was, about the manpower numbers showing, that survey showing that employers are feeling more upbeat. And, I think this wage thing probably reflects it as well. All those things work together to create a better environment here. You know, at the same time, I think there's a lot of politics that figures into this, and people end up blaming the governor or either party not doing enough. But you talk to most economists, and they'll tell you, who's in charge of your state doesn't make a whole ton of difference when companies are deciding whether to add or hire people or to expand or move into a state. I think politicians would like to take credit for things that happen one way or the other. So as much as you maybe want to blame the governor for our 35th performance on jobs, or he'll take credit for Amazon, for example, opening in Kenosha, I mean, it probably is. It doesn't make that much difference, really, who's in charge. I mean, the Wisconsin State Journal had this great graphic that they put together on their website showing where Wisconsin ranked relative to the other Midwestern states. We were ranking a lot higher under Jim Doyle when he was governor in terms of relative, compared to the other Midwestern states. So.
And, Mike, we're going to leave it there. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, guys.
That's Mike Ivey, business reporter for the Capital Times in Madison. The fermented tea kombucha is picking up popularity these days. It's made using live cultures, and some health enthusiasts say it can have beneficial effects on our digestion and our overall health. Vanessa Tortolano joins us now. She's an herbalist and co-founder of Nasala Kombucha. Vanessa, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Kombucha 101, let's start there. What is kombucha for the uninitiated?
Kombucha is a health beverage. It's fermented tea. It's got probiotics, B vitamins, C vitamins, helps your body detoxify and boost your immune system. So it's really good for you. It's got all kinds of yummies in it.
So let's describe the taste for listeners who might not have tried it. And just before the show, I did a little bit of homework, and I had a little bit of kombucha. And I have to say, it might be an acquired taste for some folks.
This is definitely not for everybody right away. Especially, different kombuchas taste differently. It's kind of like a craft beer, I can't think of the word right now, but there's different ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So different people's brands taste differently. They have different styles. Our style is a bit different. We try and balance it, but it's definitely got a tart, sweet, and fizzy taste to it. And it has like a bite that kind of hits you at the back of the throat oftentimes. And that's the sort of trigger kombucha tang that
right,
everybody recognizes.
The tang. Well, it's something that you can make at home. I think mm-hmm. you've taught classes on it.
Yep.
And given a little know-how and a little time, what goes into making kombucha?
You basically boil some water, you steep some tea, you add some sugar, and then you put it in with a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast, and that's what you use to ferment the tea. And that little guy, we call it a SCOBY. There's an acronym. I can't speak today. This is terrible. but you put that in with the tea, and it ferments. You put it in a jar with a cloth cover on it because you do want to allow it to breathe. And so what it does then as it's fermenting is it creates a new SCOBY on the surface, and that sort of acts as a barrier between the world and the underworld of kombucha and the fermentation and what's happening under there. But it also allows it to breathe. So it is a breathing, living organism. It's pretty cool.
Now, kombucha is gaining in popularity these days, but it goes back a long time. I mean, it's got a long history, but why is it getting popular now? Why the interest in it?
Well, I think people are really, really trying to gain control of their health and their bodies and what goes into their bodies. And people are becoming more and more concerned about, how to take care of your body, how to stay healthy. And so it's in that fermented food category. When you add fermented foods into your diet, you're really helping to balance the probiotics and the pH in your body. And it really helps with digestion. And when you have a happy digestive system, you have a happy body, and then you have a happy mind.
Right, we're hearing a lot about that, aren't we? About the different health effects of kombucha. And I know that people are really big on the probiotics these days, the live cultures. What is the science behind that? Do we know about what is in kombucha and what it does to your digestive system?
I mean, there's amino acids, there's lactic acid, there's glucuronic acid. A lot of the very same things that are found in like kefir and yogurt and sauerkraut are all very beneficial for the body because it does help establish a more balanced pH in your body. Because when you're out of balance with your pH, that's when you tend to get sick. That's when you tend to fall in disease. And so, yeah, having fermented foods in your life is very important and very good for your body.
But what at one point do you separate sort of myth from the science? Because there are all sorts of health claims about kombucha and what it can do. It can cure this. It can cure that. And I imagine there's truth to some of that. But some of that seems like it goes a little far afield. Where do you draw that line?
Yeah, I read on Wikipedia that some Russians used to say it could make you live forever.
Right. The tea of immortality.
Right.
It's the tea of immortality. I sit in the spot of, you need to try it for yourself and see how it helps your body, because everybody's body is differently and only you can really determine what is working for your body. Some people drink it and they're totally fine and it makes them feel great. Like, that's how it is with me. I drink it and I feel awesome. Helps bring me back into balance. You know, if I'm feeling under the weather and I notice that I haven't been drinking, I'll drink it and I'll feel better. Other people don't feel good when they drink it. So it just really depends. Some people actually get rashes and, you know, it doesn't react well to their body. So you really just have to kind of check it out yourself and see what works for your body. Also, a lot of people don't realize that you need to drink plenty of water when you're drinking kombucha, because it does help your body detoxify. So your body's going to start throwing toxins off. And if you're not flushing that with water, you are going to end up just retoxifying your body.
Let's talk about the SCOBY that you mentioned earlier. We don't have a picture of one up right now, but if you go online, it's easy to find one. It looks like this giant floating mushroom, which
right.
is a little intimidating at first blush. And I've seen them in people's homes when they brew their own kombucha.
Yeah.
Are you freaked out by the mushroom thing?
Oh, God, not at all. I play with those things all the time. We have really big ones, too.
Yeah. And they grow like a giant disc, don't they?
Well, they basically grow to fit the surface of your container. So if you have a square container, it's going to make a square because
okay.
it's sealing off the surface so that the stuff can happen underneath. So, you know, whatever shape container you have is what shape your SCOBY is going to be. And now we have 200-gallon vats. And so our SCOBYs are like 4 feet
Big
around
giant
now.
SCOBYs.
Yeah.
Is it essentially like a mushroom?
It is not a mushroom.
Okay.
It is absolutely not a mushroom. Mushrooms do not grow in liquid.
Okay. I've been schooled in mushrooms.
It's a common myth. They call it, the kombucha mushroom. But it's not a mushroom. It's more of a... It's bacteria and yeast. So the yeast is, you know, kind of fungi-ish.
Fungi-ish. You coined a new word there.
So at its most basic, it's a pretty simple recipe. But what do you, like homebrewing, I think of that. It's very basic. There's not much to it. But homebrewers get pretty exotic with trying to add things and make it taste different. Does the same thing happen with kombucha?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You know, different people experiment with juices and fruits and different, you know, I've heard of hops and adding, you know, different herbs and things like that. We do herbal ones and we do fruit ones as well, but we can't sell those because it does end up with a higher alcohol content when you use fresh fruits.
Jean looked interested at that. So I'm like,
right?
Good tip for the future.
Well, let's talk about some of the different things that you do with your lime, because you've got a whole bunch of different flavors.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about infusing the kombucha with all these different varieties?
We use straight tea, basically. It's a flavored tea, but we use it. It's from Rishi in Milwaukee, and they just have really awesome, great, high-quality tea. And so the different flavors, like the blueberry is a blueberry rooibos. So there's freeze-dried fruits. So all the flavors come from freeze-dried fruits, and they're not, you know, artificial or, you know, sort of shoved in there in the end or anything like that. They're actually steeped in with the tea, and that's how we get our flavors.
What's the most popular one?
Lemongrass ginger.
Lemongrass ginger.
Absolutely.
So that might be a good one if you're a kombucha newbie and you're a little you know, iffy like about the flavor, but it is very effervescent.
Yes.
It's kind of fun to drink.
Yes.
And I've heard that your company is kind of going gangbusters. Can you speak to whether or not this is really catching on? The kombucha thing is a trend both in Madison and elsewhere?
I think it's done being a trend. I think it's now part of people's everyday lives. 5 years ago when we started, it was nothing but education. We just, you know, we're basically educating people constantly about what it was, what it did, blah, blah, blah. And now people at least know of the word, you know, like they've heard the word if they don't know what it is in particular. Right. But most people know what it is now, which is really cool because now we spend more time selling and less time educating.
Which is good, but it also puts up the challenge. What are you going to do, you know, 5 years from now? Are you going to have to trick it up a little bit to keep selling or to keep your business? Or do you see what you have in place now being able to carry you for a long time?
We did choose our new space specifically so that we could grow over the next, well, now it's 4 years. But definitely after that, we're probably going to have to reevaluate. We may have to look at a bigger space or about maybe think of building. It mm-hmm. just really depends. But yeah, we have some very big plans happening, but I can't reveal what those things are right now.
Well, we are just about out of time. But in our last 30 seconds here, you make cocktails with kombucha. And
yes.
You gave us one, which is up on our Facebook page. Real quick, can you tell us what's in it?
No, because I forgot. It's all Jeanette.
It's got Pimm's.
It's got Pimm's in it. It's all in cucumbers and mint. And it's all due to Jeanette Dainty. I'll just boost her because she's awesome. She's our in-house cocktail events manager, and she's just rocking it and making things really fun for us. And she makes amazing cocktails, and we have a list of cocktails on our website.
And the one out on our Central Time Facebook page is there,
yep,
too. So excellent. Vanessa, thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks for having
me. We've been talking to Vanessa Tortolano, an herbalist and co-owner of Nasala Kombucha.
And you can find a recipe for the kombucha cocktail on the Central Time Facebook page.